In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask that of all my prayer. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Ethel, baby mammy. Fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast we're talking about the films of 1989, sliding down a power line here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And with us today from the You're Missing Out podcast, friend of the pod, longtime friend of the pod, Tom Lorenzo. Thanks for coming back.
Boys, it is my pleasure to talk about Tango. Shin Tango, as I'm playing with a little mouse.
So first of all, what did you see this film? I'm assuming you saw this film as a kid, Tom, or relatively, you know, when do you think you saw this for the first time?
Ooh, honestly, I probably didn't see it until late high school, college era.
Okay.
For some reason, it's one of those TNT late night movies that just was never on when I was up at night.
Okay.
It's like that perfect, just shut your brain off at 2 a.m. with a beer. You just came home and you just hanging with friends is like, yeah, Tango and Cash. Stallone is a smart guy for some reason. And
for some reason,
you know, he's got glasses, so he's the smart one. And, you know, Kurt Russell's got a hole in his shirt, so he's the disgusting one.
He's got luscious hair in this movie, though. I mean,
Kurt Russell has always had the best hair in the world.
It's incredible. So first of all, Kenny, I was surprised to hear you had never seen this film before.
So I told you that before I'd seen it.
Oh, and then you realized you would see it.
I tried to watch this movie once.
Okay.
And remember, as I was watching it, and I think around the time they got into prison, I called it. And I didn't call it. I'm like, fuck this shit. Yeah. I remember this is when I was 2 houses ago. I remember being in my basement, watching the flick, and just feeling like this isn't really worth my time. So I remember some of it. I definitely did not watch this as a kid, and this for some reason, I think it might be smart Stallone, never appealed to me. This was never something I felt like putting on in my entire childhood.
So I can't really explain why, but my mom, I think, really likes this movie. I think she also liked Lethal Weapon. Like, she was kind of into like 80s action films to a certain degree. So I saw this film a lot as a kid. I have a strong recollection of watching this film. Like, I knew way too much of this movie as I was watching it the other day, which I have not seen this film in at least 25 years. But I've got a soft spot for it in a way that watching it this time, I was just like, I mean, this movie is dumb with like a just all capitals dumb. Like it is, it's a dumb movie.
It's like I said to you, Phil, like you didn't tell me this was a silly movie. I had no idea. None. This is a silly movie. This is one of the silliest movies I've ever seen. Yeah. And like it's hard to get on its wavelength. It's kind of what I felt watching the movie. Like Palin's amazing. Palin's hilarious, perfect, brilliant. But the other two guys doing silly. Now I obviously Kurt Russell's done his share of silly. Yeah.
Kurt is in the right movie. Like he knows what movie he's in.
He's in the pocket. Yes. Yeah. He but Stallone, and this is one of the movies that immediately I just started reading about.
Oh, it's it's a crazy, crazy
production.
Yeah.
And Stallone apparently wanted it to be more serious, as did the director, whose name I'm not gonna say.
Konchalovsky.
Yeah.
Konchalovsky apparently wanted this to be a more serious movie. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if Stallone submarined it or anything like that. That's not what it seems like. It just seems like he felt like it wasn't working.
It's John Peters that really kind of is the fucking wrench in all of this.
Well, John Peters apparently is the opposite, where he's like, make this as silly as possible.
This should be the broadest, silliest. Yeah. Like, I think that ultimately the right tone for this film is probably Lethal Weapon, right? Where it's like, it's pretty serious. Right. And they're failing.
Or, to me, and this is part of the reason I kind of didn't love this movie.
Yeah.
Face Off. Like Face Off
or The Fugitive.
Fugitive is kind of serious, but Face Off is a really, really silly movie, but it doesn't forget that it's an action movie and it needs to bring it on the action elements of it throughout the whole thing. Like the escape from prison in Face Off is so fucking silly, and I love it so fucking much. It's so fun. Yeah,
John Woo, is the preeminent master of silly action movies without ever somehow sacrificing like the drama or the excitement of the moment. Because, like you said, that the jailbreak and Face Off is thrilling, and there's gunshots and people diving in slow motion, but also they're wearing the boots from the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Yeah. and the throwing up and the guy getting electrocuted, and it's great. I love it.
Love Face Off, but also
the whole island prison is brilliant. You don't find out it's an island until he jumps off it. I love it. There's no style in this movie.
No, it is. No. I mean, obviously, that's a big problem of the constant directorial changes throughout this movie. Konchalovsky was the third director.
Well, he was the second, I believe.
I think he was the second.
Yes.
No, I think he was third because he got fired 2 weeks before.
No, I heard that it was him. Then he was replaced with Albert Magnoli, who did all the chase and fight scenes.
Who
and
did Purple
ending.
Rain?
Yes. And then there was, you might be right, I think there was someone before Konchalovsky, but it doesn't matter. Long story short, there were a lot of directors here.
I read that he was the first.
That's what I read.
It was Magnoli and another guy, and then the quote-unquote fourth is Stallone.
Correct.
Well, Stallone, in this era, he's always essentially the filmmaker, the auteur of the piece, if you will, because... Yeah, I mean, one of the funniest things of him like wagging his fucking dick around of power is like Barry Sonnenfeld was the DP for a day.
I love it.
And then
so
he just had him fired because he wasn't lighting Stallone correctly.
Can you imagine how much better this film would look if it was shot by Sonnenfeld?
It would look like a crazy like storybook. You would need a cameo of Nick Cage as High from Raising Arizona
Kenny, it's interesting you bring up Face Off because I thought about it a lot as I was watching this as well, right? Which is, you're also talking about Travolta and Cage, who there isn't a scenery they don't want to chew on, right? So like they're just willing to go there. Whereas I think that as broad as Stallone and Kurt Russell can go, there is a line for them. You know what I mean? And I don't know that there's a line for Travolta and Cage.
No, there's not. They eat scenery as if it was made out of fiber and they're backed up for weeks. I really think every problem with this movie is Stallone's fault. I think Kurt is one of the preeminent doofuses of cinema. He's great at subverting his good looks and being like, look at what an idiot I am. I mean, Jack Burton is one of the great buffoons of all the cinema.
For sure, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Even he brings a little bit of that energy to Ego in Guardians 2. Like he can go funny. Stallone, he's in this period, he's got way too much hubris. His head is way too far up his ass to be silly because he's always got to look cool.
Well, the crazy thing is that Kurt Russell wasn't the first choice. They actually wanted Patrick Swayze. So, yeah. Like, Patrick Swayze in this.
And he took Roadhouse, which is the energy this movie wants.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, no disrespect to Patrick Swayze, rest in peace, but, like, not a funny guy. Like, not a guy who's going to bring you the levity. So, I think you would have got the same tone from Stallone and Patrick Swayze, and it would have been brutal.
Swayze's thing is sincerity.
Yeah.
And playing that sincerity for the humor like they do in Roadhouse. Just like, wow, this guy's like a Taoist fucking monk who's also like a bar like bouncer.
I've never seen Roadhouse all the way through, so I can't speak to Roadhouse.
It's deranged. Absolute.
Kenny, are you a Roadhouse fan?
Cinema.
Never seen Roadhouse.
Oh my god! Get me on for Roadhouse when you get.
But it's an 89 movie. We're gonna do it. I've never seen Roadhouse. It's interesting. The films of 1989 fall into two buckets for me. Movies I've seen 100 million times. And movies that have never appealed to me. And Roadhouse and Tango and Cash and the movie we just did, The Burbs, never appealed to me. They always, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, not being in on the ground floor.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then being somebody else's movie, you know? So Tang, I don't know. Like, it doesn't sound like either. I mean, Phil, you ride for Tango Cash or to some extent. Mm-hmm. But this, you know, this is someone else's movie that it's just like, I found no charm in this movie at all. I think, like, it seemed like all these, you know, all the blows I've ever seen were ADR'd and they were terrible. Like, the jokes were just terrible, just terribly unfunny. And it was, I found it to be a pretty miserable experience watching this movie, to be honest.
Really?
Except the Jack Palance stuff. Like, I thought Jack Palance was really funny. Like, I bothered me they had, you know, it bothered me that I thought the leads had no chemistry. I think the script put them, you know, at odds too much for what ultimately was a buddy comedy. I felt, you know, kind of lost when it came to the geography of the movie. I think the basic conceit of the movie is great and a lot of fun. But I think the, you know, the choreography of the movie was just insane to the point of throwing spaghetti against the dishwasher.
Okay, go ahead, Tom, please.
Well, I like this movie. I'm not, you know, spoiler alert. I like this movie. I know there's a lot of problems with the movie. It feels like it's like 5 degrees away from being where it should be, which is a parody of buddy cop movies. Like, it feels like it's trying to be Bad Boys 2 for the 80s.
Yes.
Where it's trying to crank everything to 11, but because of Stallone's insistence on being cool and being the auteur and like not deciding if it should be serious or if it should be funny. And then they decide it should be funny. But then, like, you got a director who's a fucking Russian filmmaker who got his start working with Andrei Tarkovsky and whose last movie was also a Prison Break movie that got nominated for Oscars. And so then you fire him, get another director who then's like, oh, well, also we got to film other scenes again so it could be funnier. And so, like, they're just shipping the movie wet, like, the day it's supposed to be released. So, like, nobody knows what movie they're in. Like, Jack Palance is, you could find clips of him on, like, The Tonight Show saying, like, yeah, like, I signed on to this movie thinking I'd be doing, like, three scenes with Stallone. And then I get on set, they rewrote the whole movie, and I never met him. And, like, they just didn't know what this movie was the entire time.
It's interesting. I'm completely with you on this one, Tom. I think that I have a weird soft spot for it. It's not a good movie. I'm not going to sit here and ride for it on really almost any level, but it somehow got a vibe that I locked into and was like, these two are having fun. or at least it seems like they're having some fun. It's a goofy movie. And I'm not, you know, I'm not an action, 80s action aficionado by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. So, you know, I don't have my bona fides in that respect. So for me, it's like, it's goofy, it's silly, it does what it's kind of supposed to do on an action movie level to some degree. It's not
it's got
face
a
off, which is,
charm.
You know, yeah.
It's like, it's got big himbo energy. Like it's just trying to be charming
movie.
And like, yeah.
I would also,
if you view it from a certain vantage point, and I see what you guys are saying, I think big himbo energy is a great phrase we should put all over the place. I think that I think this is a very fine thing, but I think this movie is caught up in a phantom zone of tone. Basically, Tom, you're saying Stallone's not funny enough to do funny. I agree with that. This movie is not committed to the action of it like the other Stallone movies. I agree with that too. I think they tried to meet in the middle at let's make a cool movie,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Let's make a cool movie. Cool movies are very hard to make, right?
Yeah.
And cool movies, if you don't have a cool director, right? You like Michael Bay is not cool, but I think Will Smith and Martin Lawrence are pretty cool. Right.
Yeah.
So Will Smith and Martin Lawrence are able to kind of like carry a movie based on their charm, their chemistry, and their kind of innate coolness that you're willing to go with. So you don't have to have, even though Martin Lawrence often does kind of play the fool in that, you don't have to have jokes that are constantly playing on the fact that one of these two guys are an idiot. Right.
Yeah.
One of these two guys are morons. Whereas in this movie, like Stallone just isn't a cool guy.
Yeah.
Period. End of story.
And they just and the character of Tango is just such like, well, he's one of the best cops in the business and he's tough, but also he's a stockbroker and he's got all this money and he's really smart and he's like he's got a great vocabulary and he's trying to help his is she a stripper sister? Whatever that fucking club is. Let's get to that at some point.
Well, we will, don't worry.
and he's not playing it like it's absurd. He's playing it. Like this is just who I would be. This is the real me now. It's like, oh my God. It's like I actually think it's interesting because this is kind of like where the Rocky character evolved to. When you got to like Rocky IV, Rocky's whole thing was like, I'm getting out of this because like now I like, you know, look pretty good, got some money, got this nice house.
I'm smart. I can talk now.
I'm smart. I'm a businessman. I can wear glasses.
I got this fucking robot.
But we knew where you got a robot. We knew where you came from and the whole evolution, you know, kind of worked. And then the de-evolution of that to get back to where he needed to be to fight Drago worked really well. That all makes sense. But I don't think anybody, maybe I'm wrong, people seem to like this movie, but I don't think anybody wants fucking like master of the world in every respect Stallone. That sucks.
No, because his best characters, they're always flawed. Yeah. You know, Rocky's obviously flawed. Rambo's flawed. Then you start getting into the movies where he's starting to become a superhero. Rambo's losing his edge. He's playing shit like Cobra where he's, you know, crimes of disease. He's the cure. And,
yeah,
you know,
but Demolition Man's fun.
But Demolition Man's playing in this field of like being more satirical than being straight ahead. Like we're a cool action movie. Because if you watch Demolition Man, that's like there's no like great action if you watch Demolition Man. It's more about the vibe and the fun. And like
I watched it 2 weeks ago, just because I love that flick.
Great movie.
And Wesley Snipes is super cool in that movie. And Stallone, you know, is kind of cool by virtue of the world being so fucking lame around him. You know, like that's like the whole conceit of the movie is basically look at what happens if you let the liberals take over. And it's like and it is this weird kind of thing where they actually sell you on the idea that violence is cool. And but it doesn't exist in our world whatsoever. It is a lot of fun. It is this like goofy right wing comic book, and you can accept it for what it is. I just feel like it reminds me a little bit of like what Mark Wahlberg is and wants to be right now. But I don't think Mark Wahlberg would play this character as straight as Stallone is playing it. I think even Wahlberg would be like, okay, like this is who he wants to be on the show Wall Street, right? Like this is who he wants the world to believe he is. But he is self-aware enough to be like, no one is going to buy that I'm some nerd stockbroker. I have to play it up to, you know, I have to play it up to the like 10th degree to like at least have fun with it.
You watch that, he made that movie Spencer Confidential last year, which is basically his Tango and Cash. And he's not playing Ray Tango. He is playing kind of this like shithead, just like blue collar Boston guy. And you never like tasked with having to believe that he's this fucking genius. You know, he's not doing the happening where, oh, well, he's got glasses, so he's smart. He knows the wind's coming for him.
I absolutely agree with you guys that Tango is not a great fit in terms of the role for Stallone. I think that there's these weird sort of like bearing walls or flags that they planted in this character. Like he's got to be the Beverly Hills cop, right? To Kurt Russell's downtown LA cop.
Yeah.
And I also just, I mean, there's ways of going, they just went about it strangely. That being said, once he gets out of, like once they go to prison, from that point on, I actually was fine with Stallone in the role. It's really just that first bit with him wearing suits and glasses and he
becomes more Stallone as the movie goes on.
That's kind of my point.
I think it's really just that there's too much in that character where he never feels like a real character, or at least like Kurt Russell, like Cash is like just one note. He's just a slob. But like you get it. There's not too much that you need to be like, oh, well, he's this superhero. It's like, no, he's just kind of a, you know, he's a slob and he's a cop and we don't need to know that much about him. Whereas Tango is like got 100 different things going on. You're like, I don't think any of this is like making a real character.
I mean, I think that on a screenplay level, this went through a bunch of rewrites as well. So Randy Feldman has a solo credit on it, but Jeff Boehm did rewrites on it. He just didn't want his name on it. So I think that it went through a bunch of different rewrites. But I also kind of wonder, and this is something to think about, Kenny, because we learned something in the Burbs episode, which is that in 1988 there was a writer's strike. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how that affected a lot of movies now that I think about it, in terms of what was written when and when were these things shot. You know, I'm not suggesting that I don't know what the ins and outs of this particular film are. We know that the Burbs shot during the strike and most films didn't. So
I figured out how to save this film.
Okay.
30 years later. One thing I felt when I was watching this movie was this is a Kurt Russell movie that has Sylvester Stallone in it.
Yeah.
He's got the love interest.
Yeah.
But he has a love interest, but also this feels more like your Escape from New York's in terms of like wacky, you know, in terms of tone than anything Stallone has done. And I wonder how, and it has nothing to do with this script or even the director or anything. It just has to do with the conception or putting this production together. If you cast Kurt Russell first and built the cast around him, and then said, who would be a great guy to play off Kurt Russell in this other role? I don't know if you'd get to Stallone or who you'd get to. But then I do feel like it would have worked a lot better if people recognized that let's imbue this movie with more of what Kurt Russell brings to it, as opposed to trying to fit this bizarre Stallone energy into something that doesn't want to be a Stallone movie.
I agree with that 100%.
Big
Coke
energy is this movie.
I'm going to do a quick synopsis. Police officers Ray Tango, played by Sylvester Stallone, and Gabriel Cash, played by Kurt Russell, are narcotics experts working to bring down drug lord Eves Parrott, played by Jack Palance. In an attempt to stymie their efforts, Parrott has set up Tanker and Cash, making it look as if they killed an FBI agent, arrested and put in prison. The two cops formulate an escape plan and once out, team up with Tango's exotic dancer sister, Catherine, played by Terry Hatcher, in order to clear their records and take down Parrott once for all. As we mentioned, it was written by Randy Feldman and partially by Jeff Boehm, directed by Andre Konchalovsky. Tango and Cash opened on December 22nd, 1989 by the skin of its teeth, it seems. Yep. And in second place behind National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, ahead of War of the Roses and Back to the Future Part 2. It would go on to make $120 million on a $54 million budget. $54 million, a lot of fucking money in 84. Yep. Tango and Cash has 30% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 52 from audiences. Metacritic has it weighed at 41 out of 8 out of 100, based on 15 critics indicating mixed or average reviews. The Los Angeles Times called it a waste of time and energy on all levels, criticizing the film as both illogical and predictable. The Chicago Tribune wrote that one interpretation of the film is a crafty foreigner's sly parody of the current state of American culture. That is an interpretation of the film. And in 2012, the Flophouse podcast dedicated their 100th episode to Tango and Cash. They praised it as an enjoyably bad movie and the last film before irony was created, which I think is
yeah, maybe true.
That might be true.
I think that one of the problems,
and there's just to be very clear, Kenny, there are lots of problems with this film. I am not like suggesting that this film is not flawed. I just think that it weirdly hits me in a nostalgia spot or something that makes me kind of give it a pass on some things. I don't quite know why, but I think that's where some of it is for me.
I watched, when we did our Bruckheimer screen draft, I watched Beverly Hills Cop 2 for the first time in a long time. And Beverly Hills Cop 2 is what I think this movie is aspiring to be.
That does
hit me in the right nostalgia place. That does evoke a moment in the 80s and in 80 action, in the 80s action, where there was a wink and nod towards what they were doing, a little bit of a dissecting and rebuilding of the 80s action formula that I think is great. Like, I think Beverly Hills Cop 2 is awesome. I think one is a fucking masterpiece. But
Scott's undefeated.
I think that this movie, for me at least, evokes nothing of the 80s, or at least nothing I want, right?
Well, and I think it's because this movie is weirdly not sleazy.
Yeah.
Like, when you think of these 80s movies, like Beverly Hills Cop 2, like a Death Wish 3, even like the Lethal Weapon 1 has a bit of sleaze to it. Like, you know,
there's a lot of sleaze. I agree with you.
Even the strip club scene in this is not sleazy. Like, it's, she's banging on drums and shit. And
oh my God. Like, we got to talk about that. Like, Terry Hatcher playing the drums like an infant.
I love Terry Hatcher.
I do too. But like, what is she doing?
Bro, I'm not saying you don't.
That scene is like in any other action movie, even like a year before where he's doing Cobra or he's doing shit for Canon Films, that would have been sleazy. It would have been, everyone would have been covered in Vaseline and they would have been guys that looked like they got out of prison.
I guess you're nailing it. Yeah.
and I think that's kind of what makes this like goofily watchable instead of like you watch other 80s action movies and there's more of a, like a thrill to them because it still feels like you're watching something you shouldn't be watching.
Well, I think what you're sensing is the John Peters effect, right? Like, this is a guy who wants to make big popcorn four quadrant movies. He's not interested in sleaze. He doesn't really want to be rated R.
In the absence of sleaze, which I hear you, what did they put in its place? And it seems like they put gook.
They put a big SUV with guns that looks like James Bond on steroids.
Like from every police department has a guy like that in their division, just making tanks with fucking high
Gatling guns on the side.
Yeah,
high speed Wi-Fi in 1989.
It's a queue, right? Everyone has their own queue.
Yes,
everyone has their queue. That's the guy
who, by the way, enters the movie like no joke, an hour in, and it makes it seem as though Kurt Russell and him have been on adventures for 20 years before this?
This movie feels like Lethal Weapon 3. It feels like a sequel in a series that has run out of energy.
Yeah.
Yet it's the first one and the only one.
Because the Jeffrey Boehm connection, he wrote the Lethal Weapons after Shane Black. Yep. And 1 and 2 have that danger, that sleaze to them. There's a tragic element to them. But then 3 and 4, they're just comedies. And you're watching them, you're like, okay, you guys are really leaning on the comedy and not so much of the, you know, this cop is a psychopathic Vietnam veteran who's like, keeps watching people he loves die. It's like, what are we doing here now?
That's a really good point. And that's happened that's happened with all of Stallone's movies too, right? Where, you know, you lose the pathos of what happened in Rocky, and you lose the pathos of what happened in Rambo, and you decide what people want is the, you know, the punching and the murdering. So
yes. And this doesn't even have like the energy of Cobra or Nighthawks, where it's like, okay, crime is fucking really crazy in America, so people want to watch cops just mow people down. 1989, Reaganomics is pretty much like turning things around, and nobody wants to watch just giant fucking Peckinpah squids on like mindless fucking hordes of drug addicts anymore. It's like, so like, it's just like, oh, we just, yeah, we want to do the cop movie thing, but it's got to be nice, and you know, everybody's friends with each other, and we're just like quipping the entire time. And like, oh, look, I put a grenade in this guy's mouth. Ain't I kooky?
Yeah.
It's like,
And it's you have a penis. I also have a penis. And we what it is.
That scene goes on for a very long
time. Your penis is not great. Your penis is not good either.
Oh, you got a dick and I got a dick. We're in showers.
Yeah. It's, I mean, listen, I do think though, I think that Stallone and Kurt do have a chemistry that kind of works.
There's moments where it hits. There's moments where they hit a groove.
I think they're like this. Like,
well, I just think Kurt is so charismatic and also generous in his movies. Like you like even in like Guardians 2, where you realize that Chris Pratt's the only one that didn't get better after the first one, and you're watching him next to Kurt, and you're like, oh, I feel bad for Chris Pratt, but Kurt's like elevating him. This is kind of this. Kurt's so watchable. You can kind of even watch Stallone and be like, okay, whatever, Stallone's here. I think there's one good little quip in a movie filled with quips that just land with a thud. And it's when they're in the prison scene and the guy with the big face, Robert Zadar, is like, this guy broke my jaw. And Kurt just looks at him and goes, you broke that jaw? I think that's a good joke. That's good shit.
I'm not saying it's devoid of good shit.
I think also just, I mean, listen, it is well worn. The whole, like, I'm going to sleep with your sister bullshit that goes on far too long. And
oh, but I think that's kind of a funny reveal that she's his sister.
No, I do and too. Also, and I think it's, but my point is that like they make it sing. And I think that in a situation with lesser talent, it would just land, I think, really poorly. I think that, you know, it's funny you bring that up, that Kurt Russell gets the girl. Kurt Russell, in a lot of ways, gets most of the wins. Like, it's not a particularly, like, Stallone is the hero type movie. It's weird in that way.
Yeah, because he's also the lower status guy who rises up above his station. Whereas, but the movie, as I said, is centered around Stallone's character. Stallone has like this ingenious little thing he does in the beginning of the movie to set himself up. His like apparently it was stolen from another movie, but
Police Story.
But Police Story, exactly. But it was lovely. It was well choreographed and well thought out. And this guy's a super genius, and he was cool. And he called Rambo a pussy, and you know, and he shot open the cocaine. I mean, come on.
That opening, which by the way, I think they shot like days before they released the movie,
which sounds a little bit like, and not to extrapolate too much, it sounds a little bit like Stallone being like, my character needs a big fucking amazing opening.
And
that throws the whole movie off, because now you're like, and plus it's called Tango Cash, not Cash and Tango. So you're the whole movie, you do feel like this gravitational pull towards Russell.
Yep.
But the movie is explicitly saying to you by its framing and by its title, this is Tango's movie.
Yeah.
Because he's immaculate. He doesn't make, you know, mistakes. He's perfect. Where Russell's opening scene.
That's
is,
how he speaks. I've always liked Stallone too.
Listen, I'm a New York greaseball. We were born with with Stallone above our crib. but like Kurt Russell's opening scene is he gets shot in the chest and he has to go chase the guy because
it was pretty.
You know,
did they ever explain that?
He was. It was all to really set up. It was all, you know, world famous guy whose name should always be Yvette Perrette, Jack Palance. You know, you look at Jack Palance, and that's the face of a man named Yves Perrette.
Yves Perrette, yep.
It's all to set up these two as being wild, so you can get that guy in the court saying, "Yeah, this fucking maniac like tortured me."
We got to talk about the trial because the trial is.
The best part of the movie is that these guys took the fucking plea bargain. That I've never seen.
Yeah, I know.
They didn't do it, but they took the deal.
They took the deal, and they seem fine with it. They go to jail.
That was legitimately hilarious. And they did go. And they did go to the jail that snows fire, which I was totally into too. I just wanted more of that.
I could. Yeah, there is a movie
that feels like it's on fast forward, and I love it.
Yeah, the trial is ridiculous, and we'll get to it. But I just need to. I gotta say that I laughed out loud when Kurt Russell says this whole thing fucking sucks in the middle of the trial to the jury.
Listen, because only Kurt could sell that shit. It's belligerent doofus.
It's incredible. It might be my favorite part of this movie because the trial is insane. The setup is insane. But
they get set up so easily. It's just it looks like a setup. There's a guy in a house who's been shot. Wait. And this gun.
This is a silly. I'm still not over the fact that it took the deal. Okay. Jack Palance's scheme was to set them up in such a way that they would get convicted.
Correct.
Which they very easily could have, right? Isn't that the game? Like, isn't that the whole idea? And then he was going to kill him in jail, which she's going to do either way. The fact that they took the deal to get out in 18 months is so funny.
The thing I love about Jack Palance's whole plan is, which is one of my favorite things in the movie, is they don't know who he is. He's trying to set these cops up that's ruining his business. When they meet him in the prison and he walks out through the smoke, they're like, "Who are you?
Who are you?"
And I love it that this guy who nobody knows who he is worried about the cops coming after him if he kills them outright, which no, they wouldn't. No one knows who you are, dumbass.
This reminds me of some dumb movie we did that I think we wound up liking.
Which one?
Yeah, a little like Simon Says. Just some crazy. Crazy ass. I mean, I think you put it well when you said this. It's like a movie on fast forward, and there's also some crazy shit. And it also does feel like it's directed by a non-American or a non-English speaker because it does have this almost learned understanding of American action film, like studied understanding of it. Like this thing happens and this thing happens and this happens without understanding kind of the fabric between it. Like without really understanding he can understand the structure, but not the feel. Right. And things that they make sense, I guess, but they're just ridiculous, but it's, I guess, and in retrospect, it is kind of fun. Maybe I'll change my opinion.
I think the big problem is not so much. I think it's just this guy was not the right guy for what they wanted this movie to be. I mean, his movie before this was Runaway Train, which got nominated for fucking Oscars. And it's like this gritty, down and dirty action movie with that got John Voight and Eric Roberts nominated for acting Oscars. And it is not this at all, even though it also has fucking Jailbreak, which was probably why they hired him. It was like, he just made a movie where they break out of jail. Let's do it. We'll get this guy. Whatever. He's free for a few months. Whatever. He's not the guy to be making quippy, funny, two guys just being greasy muscle heads, just shooting the shit while they kind of like easily solve the crime because they're just like, yeah, we broke out of prison. Who did it? Yves Perret. Where is he? The hangar. Let's get him.
So can I just want to stop for a quick second to just talk about Stallone and where he's at this point. He has another film in 89, Kenny, called Lock Up, which I don't know if we'll cover, but that's maybe we will. Movie. I don't know.
It sounds like we won't.
It's a prison action film. I don't know. It's got three writers. Tom Sizemore's in
it.
Anyway. But long story short, he's got Lock Up in 89, Tango and Cash in 89, then Rocky V, which is a bad Rocky movie. He's got Oscar, which is a terrible movie. Then he's got Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. So he's got a string of like a bad Rocky movie and two comedies. Like it's, and then he's got Cliffhanger and Demolition Man, which is a kind of a brief kind of reprise before.
Cliffhanger was a comeback.
Yes.
Cliffhanger, Demolition Man was a comeback. Copland was him trying to strive for the what?
And then that just never took.
Rocky Gore,
Travolta.
Do you know the story of Stop and My Mom Will Shoot?
No.
You know how, like, okay, so it was a script from the guy who wrote
Save the Cat.
And it was a script that was going around.
Uh-huh.
And Schwarzenegger knew Stallone was always, like, in competition with Schwarzenegger. And Schwarzenegger didn't give a shit. So Schwarzenegger told his agent, make it seem like we're trying desperately to get this script. Stallone heard, bought the script for a shit ton of money. And Schwarzenegger just laughed his ass off.
That's incredible. But can I also say that Stop or My Mom Will Shoot made $70 million and is 86 minutes long? So
I mean, hey, listen, I forget who said it, but all movies should be either 90 minutes or 200 minutes. Everything in between, you're a coward.
Ivan Reitman produced that movie. That movie is terrible. I saw the movie in the theater.
I've never seen Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
It's bad.
But at the time, I think the Schwarzenegger story is very funny. My understanding is at the time, people thought this was the most brilliant idea for a movie ever. Like people are like, this movie sells itself.
Yeah. It's called Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
But I remember distinctly being a young person when this movie came out and hating it very deeply. Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Just the mere fact that this movie existed. I didn't like the emasculation of my favorite action stars.
That's good. I get that.
No, you shouldn't. I'm talking about as a kid.
I understand you wanting
I should do better than that as a person. But you know, as a kid, it really did kind of irk me to see Sylvester Stallone playing second fiddle to Estelle Getty.
It's true.
Well, this was a weird period for Stallone because he like you have Lock Up, which isn't a success. Rambo 3 came out the year before, which made less money than Rambo 2, and people didn't like it. The year before that, he did Over the Top, which is one of the three movies that crushed Canon Films because it cost insane amount of money and it made no money.
That was the arm wrestling movie?
Great movie.
Love it. then he's, you know, like you said, he's gonna do Rocky V, which killed the franchise and which even the Creed movies don't even acknowledge.
Yep.
They basically erased that from history. He's got the string, then he's got this brief comeback with Cliffhanger, Demolition Man, and Copland.
Yep.
Critically at least. And then after that, he just falls off a cliff.
There's a big gap. I mean, you're also you've got The Specialist, Judge Dredd, Assassins, Daylight, all that happens before Copland. Yes. And those are all middling successes.
I think that Daylight was a pretty good and well-regarded movie. Things did kind of fall off kind of right after Copland.
Because you look like right after Copland,
Get Carter Driven.
His next movie immediately is Ants. He's a voice in Ants with Woody Allen. Mm-hmm. Then he does Get Carter Driven, I See You, a horror movie. Avenging Angelo, and then he's in Spy Kids 3. Then nothing until Rocky Balboa, where he's realized fuck, I gotta get my head out of my ass. I gotta humble myself and make real movies again.
Which was a good movie. There's a 99.
There's a 99 Stallone movie that we're gonna have to cover. Yeah. Detox. Ever heard of this?
I don't see a 99 Stallone movie.
Yeah,
maybe no. You might be looking at like producer or something.
Yeah, no. It's,
it says Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm looking on IMDb.
Yeah. Okay. It's Wikipedia has it in the wrong place. My apologies. It's 2002, I guess. All right.
Phew. Because I did not want to do detox. He does Rocky Balboa. He does that Rambo movie. That's literally him shooting from a Gatling gun the entire movie.
Correct.
He does the Expendables. He does the Expendables too. I mean, like he had this
Expendables was it? I mean, that's a hit, right? Expendables 1 was a hit, right?
But not really his movie. Oh no! It was his movie.
It made money, but people didn't like it, and it's a weird trilogy of fucking movies that I have a soft spot for, but they're kind of bad.
It's you know what? It's a really good idea, and Stallone has always kind of had in his back pocket these really good commercial ideas. And a lot of the time he's been able to execute and deliver. And like, look, I think Rocky Balboa was a really good idea. Obviously, Creed was a really good idea, you know? Yeah. So like, and I don't know who came to who with that idea, but whatever. He had to certainly sign off if he wasn't the one who thought it through. So
I kind of wanted him to win the Oscar for supporting actor for that.
Kind of.
I do. I love Rylance and Bridges Bars, but it should have been Stallone. And him signing on for Creed shows like he can be smart. Yep. Like he can make smart decisions when he's not getting in his own way. Because Coogler had to go to him with that, and he had to sign off of like, well, like, I'm not going to be the star, but I'll be in it. I'll be the Mickey. And that takes a bit of like you can't have
hubris.
Humbling.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, he lost the fight in Rocky Balboa, which I thought was kind of a big step forward for him. And and then Creed playing the Mickey character was another big step forward and kind of playing, someone who clearly has some brain damage issues.
Yeah.
But who started with some brain damage issues.
And he gets cancer and he's like, I want to die. Where it's like, that's not cool. That's not like what cool 80s hero would do. It's like, I'm just going to die. I don't care.
It's a shame that, and I love Creed and I love Rocky and Creed. I love that he just lives in this apartment. I love that he just has his restaurant. It's just, and Rocky Balboa is a really good movie. If you know that Creed is coming. Right, it's kind of a bad movie to end the franchise on, but it's kind of a beautiful like middle step between the Rockies and the Creeds. But regarding the Oscar, it's always upset me my whole life that he didn't win an Oscar for Rocky.
Yeah.
Right? That screenplay didn't win, he didn't win for actor, and he wasn't a producer. And that felt so wrong because for all the reasons we know, like that was the one of the best calling of your own shots of all time to have that movie win an Oscar and have him not take one home is a shame. And I think, as much as you want to give Oscars for the performance or whatever, I also think the narrative matters a lot, mostly because awards are stupid and he should have won the Oscar.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly didn't matter this year.
I don't remember who won. Who won the Oscar?
For what?
Oh, you Chadwick?
The narrative didn't come through this year.
I'm curious to see. Stallone is claiming that there is a sequel written for Tango and Cash that him and Kurt Russell are considering doing. I mean, listen, I'll watch it.
Oh, he'll do it.
Apparently, the Danish joke is a shot at the fact that Stallone had just recently divorced Bridget Nielsen at the time. Yep. So it was a weird.
So good at Beverly Hills Cop too.
Yeah, she's great. Let's walk through the plot for a second. This movie opens on a black screen with a fucking brutal needle drop and Stallone saying, okay, let's do this. So
that's a mission statement.
It's a statement, sure. This movie really opens with some Beverly Hills Cop energy. I mean, it's that whole opening sequence of like the taker. It's crazy how much it feels.
He was chasing that fucking movie freak because he was supposed to do Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, really?
And yeah. It was going to be him. And he kind of retrofitted his idea for what it should have been into Cobra. But he was like, he saw what Eddie got out of that movie. And he was like, fuck, like, I need a Beverly Hills Cop. Because, he didn't have a cop hero character. He had a soldier and he had a boxer. He wanted to cash in on that cop movie thing.
But like Beverly Hills Cop, we can all agree, is an astounding success, not because of the script.
No, absolutely not.
Like it's Eddie Murphy and Martin Brest.
The script is really good, though. But
it is. Yes, but you understand
it does go from a good kind of cop movie to, you know, world beating because of Eddie, I think.
I mean, because we've seen a lot of movies with a script at that level that are sunk because the hero is not Eddie Murphy.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And the cop character he should have built on was John Spartan. Like there was way more meat on that Demolition Man bone.
Absolutely. I mean,
I agree.
Stallone, he's a weird dude.
and they time traveled. They could have gone anywhere. Like he really missed the fucking boat with that.
They also never told us what the three seashells are.
I'm happy to know.
I know he's always talking about making a Demolition Man 2. He talks a lot. For a long time, Rambo 5 was going to be Rambo fighting an alien.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
By the way, I would have watched that.
Listen, that has the big cocaine energy of the 80s I would have loved to have seen. But then again, the Rambo 5 we got has him ripping a man's heart out and showing it to him. So listen, I win. No matter what, I won.
So, but you've alluded to something that I do think is I want to unpack for a second, which is the big cocaine energy of 80s action films and the stars that came out of them, right? So who are, is it basically the Planet Hollywood guys? Is it basically like Bruce, Stallone, Schwarzenegger? I mean, those are the three big ones.
Yeah. Then you get you can get some of the lesser guys
in there.
Well, Matt, I wouldn't even put Kurt in there. Those guys are like the top tier, but then you got the B movie guys in the canon range of like Chuck Norris, Charles Bronson,
right.
Seagal and Van Damme, where it's just like, clearly, you just have producers that have money. They want some like fame and attention of, oh, we're going to make a movie. And like they're doing rails the entire time. And it's like, yeah, throw some tits on screen. Yeah. And it's just like, you know, story doesn't matter. It's just like violence and tits and just like.
But I do feel like all these guys usually have one transcendent movie at least. Mm-hmm. You know, like Seagal has Under Siege, like, which is crazy for me to believe. But like
from the director of The Fugitive.
Yeah, it's like they one movie they nailed, you know?
Yeah, we kind of got into it on the
Time Cop is or Sudden Death, depending on how you fall on your
Van Damme. Sudden Death is the best Van Damme because it's a perfect movie. But
I think it's Hard Target where he punches a snake.
There are a lot of good Van Damme movies, but
it's also got Wilford Brimley as a Cajun man.
I would have said Kickboxer, to be honest, but that's just me.
Well, that's got
punches a snake.
Energy. He grabs a snake and then it's a rattlesnake, and then he just punches it and it goes unconscious. John Woo directed it, like we were talking about before. Perfect, silly filmmaker.
But I guess the reason I wanted to break this down for a second was because it does feel like Bruce and Schwarzenegger both find another gear, and Stallone kind of never does.
He was always desperately trying to, but he was never able to.
What's the gear? Because we saw it in Greed, right? Like
what's
he's
the gear you're
of
talking about? What's the gear?
Well, I even think the T2 and True Lies show that Schwarzenegger A can tell a joke that can land.
And he's also self-aware.
He's self-aware and he's got heart. T2 showed that he could actually have heart. And then Kenny and I, as we both know, End of Days is a masterpiece from 1999. But like Preach. It does feel like Schwarzenegger found another lane. And then Bruce also has those sort of like, he can go legit, right?
Bruce is a real actor. He just is. Like Bruce is a real, he's a real actor.
Was, who
has, who has range, and he really isn't an action star, in my opinion. He's a lot closer to Eddie. He's a lot closer to Eddie than those two guys.
You're right.
You know? Whereas, you know, Schwarzenegger obviously is really smart. He's really canny. He's really savvy. He like he gets that he has a unusual accent for an American action star. He gets that he has an unusual body for an American action star. He gets that he that there's no one like him, and I think Schwarzenegger is very very canny. Sylvester Stallone is like. Like when you say he has an extra gear, the dude started by writing himself an Oscar-winning movie.
You're right. You're
like
right.
That's the he never made sense to me intellectually because he comes off as such a fucking like self-important dope. But he did the thing that every actor who's ever moved to Hollywood has tried to do, and the one guy who pulled it off
is
that guy.
and again. To give him the credit, like he is the creative force behind all of his movies. He's always doing rewrites. He's essentially directing all those movies in the 80s. So he's not like complete. He's not like worthless or anything. It's just with him, he gets in his way and he thinks it's all about him. Where Schwarzenegger, like we talked about this Universal Soldier. He would work with good filmmakers. He would like find himself guys like. If not push him into becoming fucking Olivier, well, at least like, let's find another gear for you. Let's get you a script that you can like elevate. Let's like, we'll get good filmmaking. And like, even a movie that failed at the time that I think is great, Last Action Hero, is like, let's tweak your image. Let's make fun of your career and like send it up and give you something that's a little more intellectually ambitious than people give you credit for. Where Stallone's not working with filmmakers. Like, the best filmmaker he ever worked with, in an action movie, was himself.
right. Yeah, I think it's. I just think it's interesting because it does. I certainly didn't mean to be selling Stallone short.
No, I don't guess think it, you were. Okay. I just think. No, I don't think you were. I just think the Stallone. I mean, Tom, you just said it perfectly. But I think the Stallone thing is a bit short circuiting. For me, it always has been that this guy is basically the Warren Beatty of action films.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make sense to me, right? Just like Warren Beatty barely makes sense to me. It barely makes sense that someone who is like that good looking and that charismatic is also that capable. Like that, it doesn't make any fucking sense. Especially because he is like he's like a pretty boy, right? This guy isn't like, whatever you put, and it also like brings like this auteur thing to it that like Tom Cruise certainly isn't bringing to it. Tom Cruise is an insane person, but yeah, I think Stallone is hard to grok. Like it's just that simple, and I think some people think that he's easy to grok. He's just a big idiot, but it's just not the case.
Every time you want to give him credit, he then fails, and then when you want to take him for granted, he comes back with Rocky Balboa or Creed or something. And it's like, oh God, dude, like,
yes,
find some consistency. Like, we know you've got it in you, but you got to stop buying your own hype.
Which I think that cliffhanger too,
but I think that this is, I think we catch him at this point in 89 and a little bit in the early 90s where he does feel unmoored. He does feel like he's a little bit unsure of what
he's grabbing at anything he can. He's trying to find something and it's, he's not putting himself in the hands of somebody. He's just trying to be like, all right, I'm going to try to chase this thing or chase this thing. Right. And I'm smart enough because I wrote Rocky that I can do it. And it's like, but maybe if you were a little less like relaxed and you weren't in your hubris phase, maybe in like early 80s, you could have done Tango and Cash when you were like a little less up your own ass. But in 89, you're not the guy.
And that's abundantly clear in this first sequence where it just, it's all very ill-fitting. It's all just sort of like him with this, this snub-nosed six shooter standing in the middle of the street, trying to take, suit and glasses.
Speak of grabbing at shit, he literally stole a set piece from a Jackie Chan movie. So it's just like, oh, I saw Jackie Chan. I can do something Jackie Chan did, but it's not, the crazy stunts or the using the environment. It's, I'm going to shoot at a car and guys are going to fall in front of me.
But then, so that scene is followed with, as we mentioned earlier, with a Cash getting shot, but he was wearing a bulletproof vest. There's some like large drug bust going on. It pisses off Jack Palance. Cash tortures the guy who tried to shoot him in the bathroom by putting a chair on his throat. Long story short, Jack Palance gives us an absolutely amazing scenery chewing scene where he explains his plan, which is a totally fucking cockeyed plan of setting them both up, getting them both in jail, but also needs the physical metaphor of two mice that he puts in a physical maze. That will then, I guess, pay off in the end where they're two rats in his maze, I guess, when there's that whole like monster truck sequence.
As we all know, henchmen don't get metaphors. You need to literalize it to them. They're like infants. They have no object permanence. You've got to show it to them. Otherwise, they can be like, but they're two rats in a maze. What are you talking about, boss?
But it's an amazing scene that Palance is just like, and Kenny texted me this, which is true. 89's a big year for Jack Palance. He's got this and he's got Batman. And he's fucking incredible in Batman. And
he is a honey glazed ham. I would pay to watch Jack Palance read the phone book. Because it would be a fucking roller coaster.
It's unbelievable. He's
Abrahamson. Isaac.
It's just, it's unbelievable. It's truly amazing. And then we have the setup that we were talking about earlier, which is they're basically both sent to a warehouse in the middle of the night where there's nobody there. It's so clear that they're being set up.
Stallone's following the guy with the greatest British accent in the world. Definitely a British character actor and not an American. As he just follows them to an empty warehouse where apparently a giant drug bust is supposed to happen. But as we all know, nobody's ever there for those. They're all done, you know, socially distanced.
it's okay.
And Cass just shows up and is just like, oh, yeah, I heard info on a wire. And it's like, oh, well, it is my bus.
But it's
Cass
like, okay. They look like the worst police officers ever. When they get there and they're like, wait a second, what's going on? And then they're arrested and the cops have a backup pistol and the cops are in the pocket of Jack Palance. And that's what, like, you're telling me the entire, anyway, sorry.
The other thing that we're not bringing up here is that this, this movie is narrated through interstitials of newspapers.
Correct.
Yeah.
Like it's Citizen Kane. Like these guys are celebrity cops, and whenever they do anything, it's on the front page like of the newspaper. It is like it is actually the funniest. This might be the funniest movie ever made. I might have just been in a bad mood.
The last shot is this: is them giving a high five.
I know they're back on the force. They finally get a high five.
They do a he gets his predator moment with that, with the, you know, look at our big arms and their embrace.
Yeah. It's the best. Listen, it's great.
I mean,
so the trial is absurd. There's like an audio expert who makes audio of them.
I will give them,
Michael Jeter. What a
wiener. I'll give them credit for one thing. Like a good filmmaking moment is when Cash pulls out his gun when he's in the police department. It's like, who's talking with my gun? The line's off. And I'm like, okay, that's like in a good movie, you'd be like, that's good, like directing, writing combination.
Yeah.
But, you know, then Tango and Cash, the rest of the movie, you're like, oh, that was an accident.
So, Tango and Cash are sent they're sentenced to 18 months in minimum security, but of course they're transported to a maximum security prison, which houses most of the criminals that they have arrested, because Jack Palance is obviously trying to get them killed. How exactly are we supposed to believe that they got quote unquote lost in the penal system? Like, no cops can find them. No way that there's any
I know correction officers. I know cops.
Okay, all right.
It's very easy for things to go in a corrupt direction.
So Clint Howard is Tango's cellmate, and he's got a slinky, which feels like something they probably wouldn't let you have in prison, but I mean, maybe, I don't know. There's a great, there's a fight scene in the laundry room with all the criminals that they put away, which is a lot of fun, but then leads to a pretty fucked up electrocution sequence where they're both tortured. Yep.
Yeah, that was pretty rough.
This isn't okay.
Yeah, John Peters was home that day.
Yeah, he was too busy fucking snorting coke and remembering the good old days of doing hair.
exactly. So then there's this guy, Matt Sikowski, the assistant warden who helps Cash, helps them. It looks like it helps them escape, but then he's found murdered, and then Tango comes to save Cash, and then they have this ridiculous zip line situation that Kenny referred to at the top of the episode, where they use their belts to slide across the electric power lines. But before Tango is able to get out of there, he manages to electrocute that guy that you were referring to with the big jaw.
Big face.
Robert Zadar.
Big face, by knocking him into a transformer.
How did he not end up in Dick Tracy?
Very good question.
No makeup effects required.
So to clear their names, they separate. Tango tells Cash that if he needs to contact him, to go to the Cleopatra Club and ask for Catherine. And then the detectives go to visit the various witnesses that frame them in court. It's at this point, Kenny, I referred to earlier, that I wish there was a little bit more fugitive energy at this point. I wish that like there was a little bit more sort of, you know, stakes, just a little bit more feeling of urgency. But
it's also funny because Cash is the one that does the best investigation. He gets like the good info.
Yes.
Tango's just like, oh, some guy just blew up in a car.
Yeah, it's useless.
And when they meet up, it's just like Cass is like, I got all this info. And Tango's like, hello, why are you dating my sister?
So now we get to Catherine. She's at Cleopatra Club. She's putting on a dance. It doesn't seem like a strip club per se, because she's
like,
wearing
what
pants.
These movies are supposed to be. It's like has strip club, meetup energy.
Yeah.
But then she pulls out the drums and you're like, what is happening?
So they're playing a song. She's dancing. And then an electric drum kit shows up, manifested, it seems, out of nowhere, because earlier it was not on the stage with her, but it comes out of nowhere. And I swear to you, it's like a toddler's been given drums.
I thought she did okay.
Are you fucking kidding? She's whacking away at these things like she's got...
I've seen worse drumming.
She's the Neil Peart of strip teasers.
Fine. But then we get to the point of the movie, which might be perhaps its most ridiculous, which is when Catherine helps Cash escape the nightclub by dressing up as a woman.
Rough.
This was where I was like, I can't even with this. And then a cop asks, any chance at a three-way?
Yeah. Hey, listen, he took a shot. Just take the shot, baby. I like the cop in the strip club that gets like, he's like trying to follow Cash, and then she like starts just like, and he's like, cool boobies.
But then you've got this, and this was, again, like, it's fine, I guess, but, like, Catherine starts giving Cash
a
massage.
I guess. Oh, it's not fine. It's so bad. But,
it's bad.
It's so bad.
So she starts giving him a massage because he dislocated one of the discs in his back, or so he claims, or so he thinks. And then Tango overhears them with the massage, and it sounds like they're fucking, because no one would ever say the things that they're saying to each other while a massage was transpiring.
Well, listen,
that was a big joke in '89. Yeah, remember when John Candy was fucking the washing machine?
Big joke. You're right. It is a big joke.
The
sexual
and
innuendo.
And you want to know else, buddy? Look who's talking with the splinter. What Olympia Dukakis thinks they're fucking, and she's just pulling out a splinter, and they're just pulling out a splinter.
Yeah, that joke is perennial.
That was a funny thing in
'89. Well, people are fucking when they're not. Yeah,
Terry Hatcher's real. They directed her. Sound like you're orgasming.
Yeah,
it's not even like, oh, it's she like this is a mistake, and
she's climaxing
like a normal person
while saying, I think it's almost in, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, it's bad, it's stupid. But
it's hilarious. Happens.
And then Tango comes in and he's like, what the fuck's going on? And she basically Cash is able to glean that she's his sister and blah blah blah. It's fine. Then there's the grenade bit with the guy from Blade Runner whose name I can't remember.
Brian James.
That's it, Brian James, who had a lot to say about this movie. online did not mince words about how troubled this production was. Then we get Owen, the weapons expert.
Yeah.
who builds them, you know, this James Bond on steroids vehicle.
I read online that was Bigfoot the power truck. I mean, the monster truck. Tom, I would imagine you remember Bigfoot the monster truck, right?
No, that's a little before my time.
Bigfoot the monster truck was a big blue monster truck that kind of was like the Hulk Hogan of monster trucks. Like he had a Saturday – I'm personifying this. He had a Saturday morning cartoon and a whole line of toys after. It was just one of those weird 80s things that they made a celebrity out of a monster truck.
Were you into monster trucks as a kid?
No. I'm WWE. That's it. WWF.
Okay.
Monster trucks. Like what happened to you if you're going to be into monster trucks? But Bigfoot transcended any monster truck fandom. Bigfoot was a well-known monster truck. He was like the Greg LeMond of monster trucks. So basically, apparently, this machine, this truck thing, was Bigfoot, which does not seem right to me. That's not what Bigfoot looked like. But I think there were a lot of little Bigfoots too. There's a whole Bigfoot line. It's pretty hilarious. They called it Bigfoot 2. But yes, I wanted to point that out.
So they're big feet.
They got a celebrity cameo from Bigfoot.
I want to talk about this
like Alf,
this monster truck, this maze thing that transpires, which is they basically Palance is able to trap them in I what you would call sort of a, I don't know, what's that called, like a ditch, like a big ditch, like a quarry, if you will, essentially.
Yeah, a quarry.
And so they're trapped in there, and there's all these different vehicles trying to blow them up. This apparently was shot with no less than like 11 cameras going at the same time. Like it's a ridiculous sequence that I don't even think works all that well. I mean, Kenny, do you have thoughts on this big monster truck sequence? I mean,
no.
Obviously you know Bigfoot. And you're starstruck by Bigfoot. So.
I'm looking at Bigfoot right now on Wikipedia. He obviously has his own Wikipedia page. Bigfoot. It says Bigfoot, comma, a monster truck. But there was the whole line of Bigfoots. There were 21 trucks that were known as Bigfoot. There's also a Ms. Bigfoot. There was a female Bigfoot.
That's like how many babes there were when they shot that movie.
Right, a lot of babes.
The pigs, that is.
But yes, apparently, there was an appearance in Tango and Cash, along with a lot of other movies, because he was a big celebrity. I have no feelings on this. I hardly remember.
I thought that the car was pretty cool. I thought the vehicle that Owen made for them was pretty cool.
He didn't. It was made by the Bigfoot people, but...
What? Was it?
I'm not kidding. It was a Bigfoot.
Wait, no. The vehicle they had, was that a Bigfoot? No.
That was Bigfoot, yes.
Their vehicle? I thought you meant like a vehicle that showed up.
No, that was Bigfoot. That was one of the Bigfoot's feet.
I love this. I didn't know that. I apologize. I'm sorry.
They had the famous truck.
Okay, so so Owen didn't build it.
It would be weird and discombobulating if Bigfoot was a heel. Bigfoot's a face. Bigfoot is a fighter for good.
It's incredible. This is incredible. Okay.
Love it. So, this action kind of sucks. I mean,
it's not great.
It's geographically it's just absolute nonsense. You don't know what's going on half the time. Like halfway through, you realize Stallone's also firing out the side of the
Correct.
Car, and you're like, wait,
Correct.
He was firing?
Yep.
And then you're like, wait, the turret, how are they firing the turret? It's just like shooting in a straight line, and then just like, I don't know, it's just things are happening, and then it gets better once they get out of the car.
I'll say this, though. It's funny. I agree with you 100%. I think it's amazing that they had 11 cameras filming this thing, and I couldn't fucking tell you what the hell's going on. Like, you didn't have enough coverage in order to geographically, spatially give me a sense of what's going on?
Well, I mean, that's what happens when you're fucking editing like 2 hours before you got to get it to the fucking Chinese theater.
So then Palance kidnaps Catherine and starts a timer that will trigger the building's automatic self-destruct procedure. You know, it's just one of those automatic self-destruct buildings. And then after killing the security personnel and the fellow crime lords, Brian James shows up grabs Catherine and holds her a knife point, but then the guys are able to get him to drop the knife just to fight them.
Well, because he also does, oh, well, remember this, and he's got a grenade like attached to her ear.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it's...
But then I mean, it's like, then it's just a hand-to-hand combat for no reason.
I mean, you got to fight somebody while, you know, Stallone's fighting some fucking guy who's
so
there.
Catherine is... So then Catherine then gets taken by Palance and appears in a hall of mirrors holding a gun to Catherine's head. And both detectives...
In black light.
And both detectives are able to pick out the correct... Palance and shoot him in the forehead.
Yes, because some mark on his face is reversed, but then like his watch or some shit is reversed, and it's like, oh hey, we're not that bad of cops after all. It's just like, okay,
it's some lazy shit.
I mean, it's another good example. This feels like the Joss Whedon's version of Justice League. Where you're like,
oh damn,
this is a lot. I know this should be a lot longer, but somebody came in and just squeezed this shit, took everything out, and it's just like, yeah, whatever. The people that like these are morons. They don't care. It's like, eh, I don't know. Seems like people responded to this kind of correctly.
I think you nailed it. I think at the end of the day, they said the people who like these are morons. They don't care.
Well, I mean,
hey, I am a moron. So,
I know. I mean, they were referring to you specifically, but
I wasn't even told yet. But they knew this Italian.
Yeah. One day,
Brooklyn, we're gonna get this fucking dipshit from Brooklyn who's gonna go on podcast like it's 1999's Patreon. You know, this is why John Peters is a fucking pioneer. He knew that you guys were gonna make a show, that Patreon would be a thing. Listen, we got to give the guy his credit.
I always assume he had some kind of, you know, black magic thing going on. So who knows what this guy's capable of?
I mean, this just to wrap up the plot really quickly here. I love how quickly they move on from killing Palance. They're just like, whatever. Like they shoot him. Yeah.
They're like, how did you know? The monogram is backwards.
Yeah.
His ring was on the wrong finger. It's so like, does Palance just have a room, mirrored room to make it hard to kill him?
Yes.
A blacklight mirrored room. Yes.
Not dumb.
Not the worst villain idea.
No.
Someone surrendered a dragon.
You'll never kill me in here.
So then they grab Catherine. They escape as the building explodes. Cash makes a joke about fucking his sister.
Like, they're not even barely, like, it's not even close to the building. They're, like, very safely distanced. It's like, oh, we got to get out of the building. It's going to explode. Yeah. And then, like, half a mile away. And it's like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, they get to even watch it. They, like, turn around, like,
Yeah, they break out some fucking marshmallows. And it's like, hey, I'm going to fuck your sister.
And then, and then Cash is like, I should fuck your sister. And Kinger's like, don't you dare. And then they finally high five. Because they've been trying to all movie, but they keep getting distracted by other things.
Yeah.
And then they finally give a high five. And I actually took a picture of the final freeze frame because the headlines are pretty amazing. Hold on. Let me just pull it up here.
This movie does have Jackie Chan energy, you know? And I think what it's missing is Jackie Chan.
Yes. Well, every action movie is missing Jackie Chan.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
well, because it needed anybody to make inventive action, to make it like you want this balance of funny and action, but you don't have good enough action and your comedy's landing with a thud. And it's like working on that ironic level, but like you want what Jackie Chan is doing, which is like, holy shit, this guy's...
Yeah.
Like using the environment in funny ways, but he's also fucking these guys up and he's getting fucked up while he does it too.
And his bad jokes are charming. Like it's just charming. Cause like,
he's like a little puppy dog.
He's so remarkable physically that you know, anything else you get from him on a humor level is just him being adorable.
Well, he's also like, he can sell a joke. He's like, he's got that like rubbery yes. face, and like, oh, he's got a charm to him. He's like, he's a little guy, but oh fuck, he's gonna kick the shit out of me.
Which is part of the fun when he kicks the shit out of people.
So basically it says heroes again taking a cash back on the force, obviously. And they're showing their badges and their hands are clasped. The other headlines are children who dress for excess. And the other one says, ask not what the critics say. I don't quite know what we're obviously not supposed to pay much attention to these other headlines, but these articles are quite interesting.
That does seem like they're preempting.
Calling a shot.
Yeah. That's right.
They're basically saying, like, whatever.
Yeah, that's not what the critics... Don't even listen.
But yes.
Here it is, Tango and Cash.
Tango and Cash. So I want to sort of... We'll wrap this up, obviously. I guess the bigger... I just have sort of one kind of macro question, which is that in the pantheon of 80s action films, it feels like to your... You were making this point earlier, Tom, that, like, early 80s were just... They were kind of grimier. They were a little bit more sort of... disturbing, I guess, to some degree or another. And now that we're sort of kissing up against the 90s, we're starting to see those action films become a little bit more PG, a little bit more sort of antiseptic. Does this film, like, where does this film, is this film just kind of like a weird fulcrum point? Like, you can actually start to see this push and pull? Or
I think this is the dying grasp of the 80s.
the death rattle?
Well, because Die Hard came out the year before, right?
Yeah.
88, which changed how we saw action movies, that it could just be regular guys. And this big, like, the big Coke energy is kind of dying. And then the 90s start coming along and it starts getting sanitized, because once Hollywood gets a hold of them, you can't have the sleaze, you can't have the edge anymore. Because even as great as Terminator 2 is, it doesn't hit as hard as the first Terminator. It doesn't even hit as hard as Aliens.
It's a family movie.
It's essentially PG-13. Yeah.
They're different kinds of movies. I think that, you know, it's funny because this isn't the first action movie we did. We didn't mention it, but we did License to Kill.
We did.
And License to Kill is very similar in that it is trying to figure out who James Bond is going to be in the 90s.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Because you can't do the sleaze the same way. And it gets into this, you know, this Miami Vice type thing that really, like, I think people think Miami Vice was some aesthetic that took over everything. Miami Vice is just what Michael Mann could do. Right? Like, pretty much anyone else who tried to, like, play in that sandbox failed miserably, like, you know, License to Kill did. So I love 90s action. And I love 90s action because it takes itself so seriously. Sure. And because they put all the, you know, the money into the production value at every stage of those movies. I love the bigness of it. But this moment where they potentially could have maybe convinced a studio to spend more to make it a big fucking event, I think they failed. And I don't think they really knew what to do or knew where to be.
I also think it's a big fulcrum point because as the 90s are coming, action movies are changing where the choreography is taking exponential leaps, where it's no longer just have a guy shooting a gun at a bunch of henchmen. It's now like we got to do these elaborate set pieces. Ideally have a guy who could, you know, maybe throw a punch and have a fight scene. This is where Jackie Chan's starting to rise. His movies are starting to get imported over. John Woo's movies are starting to influence everything. The Killer comes out this year, which starts getting the bootlegs, and then the filmmakers start seeing that. And it's no longer, you know, action's changing. It can't just be, well, here's explosions and a guy shooting a gun. It has to have a little more mobility to it, a little more dynamism to set pieces and everything. And this is a relic. In 89, it's already a relic because Die Hard's changing American action movies, and then the Asian influence is going to start changing everything. I mean,
well, then special Walter effects Hill, are going to change everything too, right? Like
special effects are going to change everything. You know, you start importing all these guys over. We're seeing the rise of Chuck Norris, Steven Seagal, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Jackie Chan, like I said, is coming over. Jet Li is a few years off, you know, like all these things where it's like, action has to move now. It can't just be solid and just like very just
static.
Very static. And this got lumped. It's dying. And as much as this movie has some charms for a lot of people, it's not, you know, remembered as anything that moved the needle forward. If anything, it's the movie that told the industry you need to fucking stab it in the heart with some adrenaline and change things.
I'd also say casting became very important in that you could no longer hand over these films to people who couldn't do more than one thing, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I look at, you know, not only Die Hard, but Lethal Weapon. Right, Lethal Weapon was a huge step forward, and you know, love him or hate him or you know, think he's an anti-Semite, Mel Gibson is remarkable,
amazing
in those movies. Yeah. And Bruce is amazing in Die Hard. And Stallone can't do that, and I think he struggled for a long time until the industry was willing to make movies that were as big as he was at this point, right? Because he was not going to be the guy who took a typical movie to the next level like Eddie, Mel Gibson, and Bruce Willis were able to do. Mm-hmm. But he is the guy who can hang off a fucking ladder on a helicopter trying to save someone in a fucking, you know, in an avalanche. Like that, that is, you know, real life superhero shit. And that worked really well for a moment. For him, but I do think that action heroes were very quickly asked to be able to, you know, kind of walk and chew gum at the same time. Some could, I think Arnie clearly could, and some couldn't.
Yeah, this definitely feels like watching this movie yesterday. It definitely feels like a relic. My love for it as a kid obviously is diminished through the eyes of an adult who, you know, it's been a while, but I still think that it does have some charm. And I still think that there is something interesting about this kind of fork in the road moment that action movies had, and that this movie does kind of fall squarely in that sort of foot in two camps, which is weird.
This movie wants to be the Last Boy Scout.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last Boy Scout does exactly what this movie wants to be.
Better.
And Last Boy Scout hits the mark. It is Boy Scout is the Bad Boys 2 of the 90s. Because I think there's always these like one or two movies in every decade where it's like we're going to crank up the action to 11 and kind of like parody it while playing it completely straight, which is what Bad Boys 2 is. They're literally throwing cars on a highway. They go to Cuba and they destroy an entire shanty town with a Humvee. I mean, talk about fucking satirical symbolism. Earlier in the decade, Death Wish 3. If you want to see a movie that really takes fucking 80s action cinema to 11, Death Wish 3, where Charles Bronson starts a war in New York City between street gangs and he's like using rocket launchers.
I'll watch that tonight.
That's a movie.
But I, you know, it's interesting you bring up Last Boy Scout, because that's a moment too where like Bruce is on the ropes and it feels like his career might be slipping away from him. You know, you've got
You had Hudson Hawk.
We've got Bonfire of the Vanities, Hudson Hawk, Billy Bathgate, and Last Boy Scout. Then
I love him for Hudson. I mean, Hudson Hawk is such a bad movie, but I love him for it. I love that he wanted to do a movie like that. It's so
absolutely
weird.
That's a fascinating career. His early 90s is fascinating. And then obviously Pulp Fiction, Die Hard with a Vengeance changes, you know, his trajectory all over again. And he's back in everybody's good graces. But it's just really these action guys. You said it perfectly earlier, Kenny. These action guys sort of at a certain point, the industry says you're either going to be able to hack it in a PG-13 environment where we can start using you as a foil in that universe, or not, and then you're going to be kind of relegated to like straight to video shit. Like it feels like it's one way or the other. This movie is kind of like right before that sort of ultimatum happens.
And you know, the guys that ended up in direct to video pretty much deserved it. They couldn't do. Not to like I like a lot of the.
Listen,
guys,
we did Universal like, Soldier too. We talked about Jean-Claude Van Damme.
But like Jean-Claude didn't hit that point where he could show he could do anything until he got direct to video, and then something happened in him. But like Seagal, he was even when he was new, he was never going to have a second gear. Yeah. Watching him try to play in Italian twice is one of the greatest joys in cinema.
Here's a question for you guys, since you're both obviously, you go deeper on action movies than I do. Who's the guy or girl that you feel should have got there, like could have done that and didn't? Who could have gone to the next level? Like could have sort of transcended outside of the R-rated action movie. Like, is there someone in that pantheon that you feel didn't get their shot?
I think there's a guy right now that Hollywood really needs to take a look at, and it's Scott Adkins.
I knew you were going to say that.
I think that guy's an unbelievable performer, and he's shown in like the last few years the range he's got, because like he's now doing not just like straight action movies. He's doing shit that are like Guy Ritchie movies, and he's doing them better than fucking Guy Ritchie's doing them. And he's got like this like low down dirty like fucking British gangster energy to him, but then he's got the physicality to it. And I would love to see Hollywood take why the fuck didn't you get him to just make Mortal Kombat? Get him and his team, give them $10 million, and you'd have an R-rated Mortal Kombat movie that isn't a punchline.
I didn't see Mortal Kombat yet. Have you watched it yet, Kenny?
Terrible.
No. I don't know if I'm going to watch it.
I haven't heard
honestly. Honestly, as writers, you guys should watch it, because there's so many decisions just from a writing standpoint where you're just like, how did you make this decision?
Yeah.
And it's just such a fundamentally, it's everything wrong with mainstream nerd cinema, where it's just, we're going to set it up. It's all a setup for a sequel. And look at this Easter egg, though. Like we said, get over here.
I have an answer to you, Phil, that I don't think is the most interesting answer.
I'm curious, though.
But a guy that, and this is more of an 80s thing, who should have been one of the biggest stars in the world, and he's still kind of kicking, is Carl Weathers. Like,
yes.
Carl, like, he always kicked ass.
Yep.
He always, you know, he was able to do kind of heightened action and the smaller character pieces. And he just kind of never really got his shot outside of this action world. But I think even things like he was in Arrested Development, he was really funny.
He was.
Right?
Yeah.
He was in Happy Gilmore, he was really funny. Now he's literally directing episodes of The Mandalorian. Like, the guy had that, you know, Danny Glover had a shot a little bit. And Danny Glover was so good in Royal Tenenbaums. And he, you know, he should have had more opportunities like that. But Carl, I don't really understand why there wasn't that moment for Carl Weathers in the early 90s to kind of take on a larger kind of presence in Hollywood movies.
Action Jackson's kind of like the crank to 11, what we wanted this movie to be, version of like an R-rated, just deranged fucking like, Craig T. Nelson's a dyed blonde, like Detroit automobile guy who's like having people killed, and Carl Weathers is a beat cop, and he's like getting into foot chases with taxi cabs, and he's like outrunning full speed ahead cars, and I don't know. That movie didn't make money. You know, he's a black guy. You know, you hate to say it, but he's a black guy who got his chance and it didn't
work. He's a black guy who's not funny, right? So there's a certain lane that we allowed black guys to go in the, you know, 80s and 90s. Yeah. But I bet Action Jackson made a lot of white people uncomfortable, right?
Definitely, yeah.
For sure.
My friend Vice Victus tweeted the other day, he's got three of the best death scenes of all time in Rocky 4, Predator, and Happy Gilmore.
Oh, Happy Gilmore is so good.
The guy's a legend. It is. That's a good call. That is really, because he's great in Action Jackson, and he's got such a great presence, and he's got a physicality to him, because he was like a football player.
Yeah, he was a real football player.
Had a splash as Apollo Creed, where you're just like, wow, this guy, like, that's a tall order to ask someone to try to like be essentially Muhammad Ali, and he didn't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
I have a slightly off, perhaps a weird choice, but Gina Davis.
I think you're almost saying the opposite, that Gina Davis should have had more action roles, right?
Yes. Yes. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, I feel like I understand why Cutthroat Island was the debacle that it was, but Long Kiss Goodnight is fucking great. And I know we're talking a lot of Shane Black movies here, but truthfully, she's fucking great in that movie. And I think that would have been a really interesting. It's a shame that Hollywood was like, well, fuck this. But like, you know, and obviously her marriage with Renny Harlin went sideways and whatever. But I just think that she could have been an interesting action hero. And I obviously, it's the 90s and people weren't ready for women to be action heroes. It's debatable whether or not they're totally ready right now. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's the truth.
Yeah, very true.
So let's rate this. I'll go first. In 89, as I mentioned, I watched this many times as a kid and had a soft spot for it. Probably would have given it a 75 back in 89. I think that it was a movie that I enjoyed and watched probably too many times. Before this podcast, I was probably being too generous to this film. I think I was at a 65 before we started talking. But, you know, we've talked a fair amount, and I think I'm down to like 58 now. I don't know that this movie is great by any means. But you know,
I'm shocked how low you got. Shocked.
Yeah, I think Lord. That I really just think that when everything is said and done, it's coasting on its charm of its leads. It's got some messy but halfway decent action sequences. You know, Jack Palance is obviously fucking great. I didn't hate this movie. I would recommend this movie to people if they asked me. I'm probably at a 60, if I'm being honest. 58 might be too low. I'm at a 60.
I didn't mean to bring you down that low.
No, it's fine. I think that ultimately, it's a relic, as we've talked about earlier. I think it's a movie that has a weird place in the pantheon of action movies. And I'm happy we did it. I'm happy we talked about it. I'm happy that I got to watch it again. I'll probably never watch it again, but it was a fun movie.
It's weird because I thought I was. I gave it a 66 when I watched it, and I feel like that's, you know, 66 isn't such a great grade for me, but it still is. You know, like I don't know. It's a good time at the movies. And I almost feel like
recommendation.
You pulled me down, Kenny.
I that's why when you went to 58, I'm just like, man, he's gonna be lower than me because I'm gonna stay in this general region. I'm gonna keep it right at a 66 because I do think that it's dumb as shit and silly beyond words, but like it's a fun movie to talk about. You know, this wasn't a podcast where we just sat and like left at it the whole time. It did kind of feel like we were doing what the movie wanted us to do with it to some extent, which makes me think it was successful and, you know, not as successful as it wants to be, but successful to some extent, not like, you know, The Burbs where we were like just fucking kicking the shit out of it.
We're
all
just dunking on that for 2 hours.
But you know, and basically saying, we see what you're trying to do and you failed in every respect. I don't think that's what happened here. I think this movie could have been great, but it certainly wasn't like an embarrassment.
I agree.
We're going to stick at 66.
All right.
Tom, what do you got?
Where are you at, Tom?
All right. So first time I saw it back in the day, I probably would have thrown it a 70. I was like, I like this, but it's not the best I've seen from Stallone or Kurt. Before the podcast, I would have given it like a 75. Because like I said, I grade like I'm grading a fucking paper. So for me, like this is in like the B minus C plus range. I'm going to stay at a 75 just because it's got that big himbo energy I mentioned before.
Sure.
I think Kurt's great as always. Kurt's never been bad in a movie. So that can power most anything you watch. Jack Palance is fucking beaming in from another dimension and I love it. It's just got, and it is just like, just a relic of an older time that we didn't get immediately after, and we don't get anymore. And it's just like a nice time capsule to look at, like the move from the sleazier era of action to kind of more dynamic, yet maybe more four quadranty, safer, whatever action in the 90s, which. Honestly, probably blow for blow, I'd say the 90s. I think I like more 90s action movies, like at a higher level than 80s action movies. Like, I put Face Off above anything Stallone did in the 80s.
Well, I'm, you know, it's funny you bring that up because I'm going to be very curious to watch The Corruptor because we're going to talk about that with you on the 99 podcast, which is a film that I've never seen, but I think falls in a weird gray zone, right? Like, I think that's an R-rated movie, if I'm not mistaken.
It's an R-rated movie, but it's more of like a crime movie.
Okay.
It's a movie that got a lot of like bad reception because the Chow Yun-fat element made people think it would be an action movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's not.
Okay.
It's trying to be like, maybe not necessarily Payback, but in that kind of like pulp paperback novel mystery kind of thing.
Okay. Because I saw The Replacements in the theater, but I never saw The Corruptor.
I haven't seen The Replacements.
The Replacement? Different Killers.
Produced by John Woo, though.
Yes, and starring Chow Yun-fat and I believe Mira Sorvino. Am I making that
up?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And I remember that was a big deal because it was his first American film and everyone was like,
International action star Chow Yun-fat is making his appearance in America. And it's like, all right, fucking yeah, like let's see it. And it's like Replacement.
I remember
it's because they're not allowed to treat stuntmen like disposable fucking income.
One specific moment from the trailer, which maybe you'll remember, and I don't know if you remember it at all, Kenny, but Chow Yun-fat is sliding across the floor and he uses a gun to stop himself from sliding. Like it skids across the floor and the camera angle is on the gun as it stops. Like the trailer ends that way. And I remember thinking like, I mean, okay, I don't know why this guy's so, why everybody loves this guy, but I went to see it because I was curious. I had not seen any of John Woo's movies, so I didn't.
Very much looking forward to, to that.
But The Corruptor should be fun.
We'll talk to
Mark Wahlberg.
89 also has The Killer. If you guys want to expand out to a Hong Kong action cinema.
We can certainly consider it. But more than anything, thank you for coming on to talk about Tango Cash with us. We can't wait to talk about The Corruptor with you.
My pleasure.
I want to watch The Killer, so maybe we will.
We'll do The Killer. You want to do The Killer and Roadhouse?
Because Chow Yun-fat's name in the movie is Jeffrey. So I'm into it. All right,
Hard-boiled, his name is Tequila.
That's incredible. All right, well, thank you so much, Tom.
Tom, always great to have you. Are you guys already on to your next year?
No, we just did the finale episode. That should be out next week because Citizen Kane just dropped this week.
I saw that. What's the finale?
It's just us going through all the movies and kind of like doing our Oscars for the first year, picking our like best actor and director and all that kind of stuff. And then looking at the next year, what we're most excited for, what we haven't seen yet that we're most excited for.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, we did that.
I'm going to look at the list now and claim something.
All right. Well, Tom, I look forward to having you on here and I look forward to being on your podcast.
Oh, we're going to definitely get you guys out for something. And I'm excited to talk more 89 and 99 cinema with you boys whenever you guys ask me back.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.